You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. It's well known that we have a full-blown mental health crisis in Oklahoma. In addition, our problems with substance abuse, particularly the growth in opioid dependence, has been a front-page news story for more than a year now. It's obvious, then, that there's greater need for mental health services in both Oklahoma and the United States. But we have a healthcare system that still relies on episodic, widgetized care that pays in increments for each unit of healthcare delivered. This leaves less measurable, commoditizable entities like talk therapy largely outside the system. Nowadays, it's medications like Prozac, Paxil, or their sister pills that we take, overwhelmingly preferred as a much more quantifiable, objective treatment for what ails us. In therapy, the measurable and goal-directed, time-limited cognitive behavioral therapy has become a favorite of health networks and insurers because of its focus on symptoms and its finite nature. My guest today, Dr. Enrico Nalaudi, is a licensed psychologist in California who laments the demise of a fuller array of talk-based therapies. His criticism of our present state, with an excellent history of the field going back to the days of Freud, is in his new book, Saving Talk Therapy: How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care. It's just out from Beacon Press. Nalaudi looks at the ways in which mental health has evolved and doesn't paint a positive portrayal of the forces competing to provide the most care. Enrico Nalaudi, author of Saving Talk Therapy, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Enrico Nalaudi, welcome to Medical Monday. Your book, Saving Talk Therapy, it starts out as kind of a compendium, really, of 20th century psychiatry, psychology. Of course, you pretty much have to start with Freud. Can you take us through briefly what you wrote about? I mean, so how did things evolve, you know, from, say, post-World War II onward? I mean, we had a dramatic shift in sort of public perceptions of talk therapy and wound up in a very different place. And you make an interesting argument in the book. But where did this all start?
Well, yeah, I took great pains to lay it all out for an interested reader. I mean, I thought that was important to, like, really trace the roots of quality talk therapy. And then I wanted to really dramatize how popular therapy was in America. It still is. I can get to that. But, you know, it really was a cherished institution. It used to be that going into therapy meant something. You know, talking in the 60s, post-60s America, actually leading up to probably the advent of Prozac in the 1980s, where that, in combination with the rise of managed care health insurance, and then some other things going on in academic psychology, really you can trace the decline in quality talk therapy but back to the late 80s. And so I kind of sketch all of that out in my book, hopefully in clever, entertaining, readable ways.
I would say very much so. I mean, I really enjoyed it as sort of a survey almost of the landscape in the United States of, well, and a little bit, you know, of course, back from, you know, Austria and Europe about, you know, the sort of the history of psychotherapy. And of course, there was, if you don't mind, I mean, let's stay basic for a second. Remind us what the differences are between, say, psychoanalysis, psychiatry, psychology, because we tend to throw these terms around, but they have very specific meanings.
Yeah. I would have to speak in gross generalities, which is okay, because even within the field of psychoanalysis, there's just so many different sub-schools. And so it, broadly speaking, I'm going to differentiate maybe between psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy and humanistically oriented psychotherapy, which I, in my book, really associate with quality talk therapy. And then on the other side, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is all the rage these days, and it's actually the most predominantly practiced type of therapy in the field. So with your more humanistically, psychoanalytically oriented psychotherapy, it's really about clients coming in and telling their story, their life story at their own pace, given ample space and time to, like, really unpack what's troubling them, what's bothering them, And the therapist is more likely to be what's called non-directive, to sit back, listen, speak when they only really have something important to say, really tracking and tracing and following the client's minute-by-minute disclosures, waiting for something of value, of meaning, of significance to pop up, and then commenting on it, but really allowing for clients to emotionally unburden themselves, to explore their past, to kind of look at childhood traumas, to talk about their current relationships, their current career, their current job, does it fit with their intrinsic talents and abilities. And so that's what I would consider quality talk therapy. It's informed by psychoanalytic ways of practicing and thinking, and humanistic ways of practicing and thinking. On the other end is more cognitive behavioral therapy, and these days it's more agenda driven. The therapist is more likely to be directive in the room, more trying to kind of get. It's protocol driven. It's about trying to get the client to identify problematic thought patterns, change those thought patterns, look at their daily habits, certain behavior patterns that are getting in the way of them being productive, being functional, measuring progress in terms of like symptoms. And it tends to be more of the short-term variety than the long-term variety. So those, and I'm speaking in gross generalizations, but hopefully that's helpful for your listeners to hear it framed that way.
I think it is. And also, it has a lot to do, as you alluded to, with the advent of managed care and pushing for more of a more outcomes-based approach. That is, how do we know that people, sitting with a therapist in a room, on indefinitely as the sort of archetype of it, Freudian analysis, or you mentioned in the book, Woody Allen is a sort of a lightning rod, but someone who is very open about the fact that he has undergone analysis and continues to do so. And you sort of make the distinction about whether someone is dependent on therapy versus it being productive. So It seems like you're trying to thread a needle. Like, too much may not be a good thing, but certainly it seems like the predominant form nowadays may not be nearly enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we get deluded into thinking that psychotherapy is just an indulgence for the worried well, and that's often conservatives will come back and say that. Actually, that is by far not the problem. The problem really is that too few members of society are getting too little psychotherapy, where it's been shown that good quality psychotherapy can be really effective in changing people's, really improving their mental health. So we actually have an unrecognized psychotherapy dropout crisis in the country right now. About 38% of people who enter therapy will drop out after the first couple of sessions. Something in the range of about 9% of people who start therapy will continue for 20 or more sessions, which is really the bare minimum in terms of being able to, at least what the research shows, is the bare minimum to achieve or attain any kind of meaningful, lasting change. So that's an issue. I mean, it's not that it's not Woody Allen syndrome we should be worried about. It's more like a therapy insufficiency syndrome. That really is the heart of the matter.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann, and my guest today is Dr. Enrico Nolaudi. He's a licensed psychologist and author of the new book, Saving Talk Therapy, subtitled How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care. And Enrico Nolaudi, a big focus of your book really is cognitive behavioral therapy, so-called CBT, which has a tremendous amount of weight, I guess you could say, behind it. And it is just weight, because I think you really are not happy with what you'd call the evidence base behind it. In fact, you go so far as to call it evidence biased, which I thought was kind of funny. Kind of an interesting term. What are some of the problems as you see it with cognitive behavioral therapy? And this, and I guess maybe try to give us some context too on, you did at the outset, about why it's become so popular, because it is a more outcomes-based, more of a checklist type of therapy.
Yeah, and I think for the average American, it's very alluring, at least the idea that change can happen, significant change can happen quickly, that you have the power, willpower, the ability to kind of will yourself to change, to track your problematic thoughts, have something productive outside of the therapy office to use to change the types of thinking that get you in trouble in life, and to set goals in terms of behavior changes that you would make. And so it has an air of productivity, efficiency. It typically happens over shorter lengths of time. And who wouldn't want that? I mean, I think, especially in American culture, that ethos really fits with what's near and dear to us all as, you know, supposed rugged individuals. But I think that it really diminishes and oversimplifies for most people how long it takes to really achieve meaningful and lasting change in your life. You know, and people don't come into therapy really to address symptoms in some medical kind of way. People come into therapy because they're worried if they're still in love with their spouse, or they're alarmed by the fact that they love their daughter but they don't like her as a person, or they're worried about their sexual identity, or they're worried that they prematurely committed to a career and now they're locked in. It's really problems in living that most people come into therapy with. And with cognitive behavioral therapy, they often get shunted into talking about progress in terms of having fewer symptoms of anxiety and depression, which can really shunt the discussion away from what clients really want. And frankly, when you survey people in terms of what they want out of therapy or what they consider as quality therapy, they're not interested in therapists having mastery of the latest techniques. What they're really interested in is things like wanting someone who's a good listener or has sort of a warm personality, you know, who's capable of exquisite, accurate empathy. I mean, these are the things that when you survey people, these are what they want in a therapist. And what they want out of therapy are things often like to be better at, you know, giving and receiving love, to be more self-confident, to just feel better about themselves. They'll often talk mostly in subjective, vague terms like that, that are hard to measure, but of essential importance.
You write about Aaron Beck, who was a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania, as the, I guess, originator of a CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, and that he was really a researcher at heart. And so he didn't have, in some ways, or this, since this was so much at the beginning, I mean, he was really just out to see if this concept, I guess, made sense or had some validity to it. But I guess you write that he didn't really anticipate just how big it would become.
That's correct, yeah, and it has become very big. And one of the reasons that cognitive behavioral therapy has become so popular is that its rise coincided with the release of Prozac. And, you know, I actually, it was around the sort of the late 80s, 1980s, early 1990s, and I myself was in graduate school at the time, and looking at being released from graduate school into a mental health terrain where I thought I was going to be made obsolete by drugs like Prozac. You know, psychologists and therapists were terrified back in those days that they were being put out of business by these, you know, like Prozac and its medicinal cousins like Zoloft and Paxon, that were all marketed as very safe and effective drugs. And so our field was in crisis, and we needed to come up with psychotherapy models that that could have a fighting chance against medications. And so Aaron Beck, to his credit, was the first to like really conduct what are called randomized controlled trials with using cognitive behavioral therapy, the same research methods that drug companies use to verify the effectiveness of their product. that, you know, Aaron Beck did the same for cognitive behavioral therapy, and that gave psychotherapy a fighting chance against medication, and then it stuck. And so cognitive behavioral therapy then became seen in the field as the premier treatment approach because it had the same scientific backing as medications did, and it sort of took off from there.
And moreover, it, as you point out, with randomized controlled trial, the highest form of medical evidence, of scientific evidence, it coupled neatly with, if I recall correctly, Beck was also the originator of the Beck Depression Scale. So this kind of checkbox sort of enumerating symptoms and coming up with objective data scores to sort of diagnose yourself or diagnose your client or patient. And then to be able to use cognitive behavioral therapy that's very goal-directed and with some finite or limited number of sessions in order, it is quite appealing, you have to admit.
Of course, yeah. Especially to insurance companies, but also to academics. I mean, but these shorter-term cognitive behavioral-type therapies are far more logistically easy to conduct. Think about it. Just purely from a cost standpoint, imagine a study that is a 12-session study, maybe it lasts 3 months, where you're measuring progress in terms of symptom reduction, where you can have participants just check boxes, and the attrition is manageable. In other words, people that fall out of the study is over that length of time. Versus a study, let's say, of long-term in-depth psychotherapy that lasts for 2 years. Imagine the cost of that and the problems associated with that in terms of attrition and subjects dropping out of the study. And think about it even more if you start to measure progress in terms of someone being more self-forgiving or someone being less defensive or someone being less likely to have issues with authority figures or someone. You see where I'm going with that. It becomes much more complicated and difficult to conduct those sorts of studies. And frankly, in a publisher-parish academic environment where professors need to really get quick publications in the mix in order for them to get tenure, these shorter-term, more convenience-based studies really get favored in terms of, the need for publications for academics, the need for them to get tenure, and I address all that in the book in terms of just bias that comes into play. That there's a overproduction of these types of studies in the field that really. I think, and I've written a paper on this that should get published soon, on the ethical problems with oversaturating the field with short-term, protocol-driven kinds of therapies. It leads to the perception that meaningful and lasting change can happen over the short run. As a client, you just sort of somehow will yourself to change through changing your thoughts and your behaviors. And I think for some clients that works, but for most it doesn't.
Yeah, and you make that very interesting point that you just referenced, which I hadn't really thought about, but just that these clinical psychology and psychiatry departments are sort of so one-sided, where everybody, it's a generalization, but where the vast preponderance of people in those departments just have, accepted, as it were, the CBT is the way to go and the way to advance your academic career. So there's really like very few other schools of thought going on or any kind of like good intellectual arguments going on.
Yeah, even, and I actually see it as an ethical issue because I think that the public at large is misserved. I mean, I also, if you really dig deeply into the research, and I do that in my book, it actually shows that what has always been true in the profession, things like the qualities in terms of what constitutes good therapy, it's really things like therapist empathy, how accurately they're able to empathize with clients, how well they able are to build rapport with clients, truly listen, exhibit warmth and genuineness. It's these types of qualities that lead to effective psychotherapy. And there's an abundance of research there on these issues that really doesn't get much press. And actually, more cynically, it's rare, actually rare to non-existent. If you look at the types of courses that are taught in graduate schools these days, there's no courses on, you know, how to manifest accurate empathy, or how, you know, how to build rapport with clients. These are seen as somehow other qualities that, as a therapist, you'll pick up along the way. But there's no real intensive focus on that type of what's called procedural knowledge, where, you know, know-how, you know, the empathic know-how. So, you know, really, if we were really to be scientific about it, and that we were to, if therapist education training was to really be governed what science shows, there'd be a lot more courses in graduate school on how to show empathy and how to build rapport with clients than research methods and experimental methods and all the supposed, all this scientific sounding courses that currently exist.
Well, you have a pretty fascinating personal journey, and then you write about, which was that you, I think, essentially were considering the priesthood in Scotland, where you can hear a touch of the accent still there. And then you, I guess, how did you wind up going, leaving the priesthood and then wind up in the United States? And I think in California first, or where you were in school. And then what I was interested in, too, was you write about how you decided to do your master's program at Seattle. And I loved this, existential phenomenological psychology, which was one of only two graduate programs in the U.S. that viewed psychology as a human science rather than a natural science. So a very thoughtful selection you made in terms of where to make application. I mean, what an interesting journey.
Yes. I mean, I'm a living example of what used to be called following your bliss. I mean, I think back in those days, sort of in the mid-1980s, I was sort of on an intellectual journey. I mean, I think, you know, I trained for the Catholic priesthood in rural Scotland, in Aberdeen, Scotland. I spent my entire adolescence there from about age 13 till about age 17 and a half. When my family emigrated to the United States, I was given a choice of staying in the family or coming, you know, to the United States. And I chose to move to the United States with my family, and then from there, you know, I had an emotional breakdown in college. I mean, I literally led a very cloistered life, and kind of went from that to being dropped down in a high school in Southern California, literally overnight. You can imagine the effects of that on my psyche.
Culture shock.
Yeah, I went from literally not being around girls, period, for like 4.5 years, all of a sudden being in Southern California, where it was a sort of a co-ed high school, where it was like, you know, shocking and at so many different levels. Anyway, long story short, it caught up with me psychologically, and in college, you know, I essentially had an emotional breakdown, and one of the reasons I wrote Saving Talk Therapy is because at that time, therapy became a life support system for me, and it was hugely important in terms of just helping me acquire a solid sense of self. And so I, you know, back then did a whole bunch of reading and you know, in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, existential philosophy, and then decided that I wanted to get a master's degree in a program where that was the prevailing sort of philosophy of treatment. And there's so few of them in the country. And I found one at Seattle University. It's still in existence today. And it's a classic story. I packed everything I owned into a VW bus and went from Orange County in California and drove all the way to Seattle and got my master's degree there and worked at a community mental health center for about 5 years after that. And it was a wonderful educational experience that sort of stuck with me and, frankly, kind of informed, you know, any of the readers who decide to get the book will see how my early early educational experiences at Seattle University really continue to inform the way I think and the way I work.
So what's your view of the future, given the constraints on time, on insurance payments, the seemingly endless supply of, you know, non-therapist clinicians, be they family physicians or internal medicine docs like myself that prescribe the vast preponderance of SSRI or antidepressant anxiolytic drugs? How do you see a way forward for talk therapy that goes beyond kind of the what I'd now call conventional CBT on into the future?
That's a good question, and it's hard to predict. I mean, I think what you are going to see more and more of are what are called integrated models of care, where there'll be sort of a psychotherapist down the hall from an internist or a family practice physician, where if a patient presents with what is primarily a psychological issue, not a medical one, where they can get a quick intervention. So you're going to see more and more of that. And at one level, I think there's absolutely a place for that. And frankly, there's a sort of a medical cost offset component to that. I think it's much more costly to undergo avoidable medical procedures like MRIs and CAT scans and tests when really it's a psychological issue that can be much more cheaply addressed through an immediate intervention with a mental health professional. So definitely there's a place for that. I just worry, though, that working in medical environments along with medical practitioners, that psychotherapy will continue to get medicalized, and there'll be the discourse will be one of, you know, symptoms and the reduction of symptoms rather than, you know, opportunities to grieve the loss of a partner, or, you know, to talk openly about the direction one's marriage is heading, and so on and so forth.
Well, I do hope that your vision of an integrated model comes to pass, because it feels, like you said, there's a real insufficiency of opportunity for people to engage in meaningful talk therapy nowadays, where the need is arguably ever more present. And as we work, I think, to reduce stigma certainly associated with mental health and try to achieve parity. The name of the book is Saving Talk Therapy: How Health Insurers, Big Pharma, and Slanted Science Are Ruining Good Mental Health Care, just out from Beacon Press, and it's by my guest today, Dr. Enrico Nalaudi, who is a licensed psychologist in California. Dr. Nalaudi, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.